of aid to needy children. I don't know what you say, of or for, but she's in that category, and she's supervisor of this division. She has been, however, with our local agency about 7 years and has worked in all aspects of the social welfare department, adoption and old age and so forth and so on. She is a graduate of UCLA in Los Angeles and has done her graduate work at Cal, having gotten a master's degree in social work, which qualifies her very well for the position that she's in. She is here to offer first some information and then to tie in some of the social welfare program with your needs now or I should say, perhaps later in your lives. There will be a film shown immediately after intermission. Is that one you had a plan for? Immediately after intermission, and we'll try to have our usual question and answer period. This time, however, when a question is asked from the floor, it will be repeated loudly for the benefit of all. One more thing, there will be a quiz in all sections, including Dr. Coyne's and mine, 2 weeks, in 2 weeks. So if your discussion sections come up any time in 2 weeks from, it would start from the Tuesday on, you see, I would think. From Tuesday on, right after the following election. In 2 weeks, there will be a quiz on chapters 1, 5, 6, 7, and 8 in Peterson. Chapters 1, 5, 6, 7, and 8. My sections know this, but I'm not sure if Dr. Coyne's sections know it. Hey. 1, 5, 6, 7, and 8 in Peterson. It's a short quiz, true, false, multiple choice, about 20 to 25 questions. Kind of a little something covering those chapters. Your midterm, incidentally, when it is given, will be given in this room. Everybody will take it en masse. And I haven't decided on a date for it yet, but you will know that shortly. I won't answer any questions because I might get some. I think if we're ready now and kind of settled in, I'd like to present Miss Weiss.
In introducing me, there is one thing that Dr. Gould didn't say. I think he didn't realize it. I've spent 19 years of my life going to school, and in that 19 years, this is the first time I've ever stood on this side of the lectern. So if I seem a little nervous to begin with, it's because perhaps I'm expecting I'm going to be quizzed on this performance, too. You're probably wondering just where a lecture in public welfare fits into a course in family relations. To most people, public welfare means only that the government gives money to the poor. That is true, but it is considerably less than half of the truth. Public welfare also gives a wide variety of services to all people. And this, a combination of money and service, is aimed toward just one goal, the protection and preservation of normal family life. There is even a closer tie to family relations than this. Most of the things that happen to people, the things that bring them to a public welfare agency, are the result of a serious disturbance in family life. Things like unemployment, like prolonged illness, marital conflict, divorce, estrangement of parents from their children, or the sort of thing we're going to see in the film later this morning, forced retirement of older people who are not yet ready to change their whole pattern of work and useful living and retire to semi-uselessness. These things can happen to anybody. Even to you. I've no doubt that among you in this classroom, there are a few whose lives have been touched at some point by a public welfare program. I know this is the case with some Pauli students because I've seen them, or members of my staff have seen them. For example, a young disabled veteran who has a family. He is drawing some disability benefit, but this is not enough to support his family. His disability is such that without a college education, he's not going to be able to support his family. He can't do heavy physical labor. He has to equip himself for a professional job of some kind. So he comes to our agency for financial help and for social service to help him get through college, to equip himself for a future. In situations of this kind, service is just as important as money, and the public welfare will not only support financially, but will also try to help correct the significant factors in any family situation which has either brought about the crisis or is making it something beyond the person's control, and will try to help prevent the reoccurrence of these things. Let me step away from public welfare for just a moment to mention social insurance, because I think there's going to be a gap here. The Social Security Act, which contains the nucleus of all public welfare programs, also provides for several social insurance programs. Imagine you're all familiar with Social Security. If you've ever had a job, you have a Social Security number. Out of every paycheck you receive, some percentage is deducted. Right now, it's 2.25% of every paycheck. Your employer pays the same amount. This is like an insurance premium. It's paid into the Social Security Fund, and then benefits are payable to you in the form of an annuity when you retire, at age 65 for men or at age 62 for women. These benefits are also payable to your survivors, your dependent children, if you die. Unemployment insurance is another social insurance program that also provides for some people some of the time. Here, the insurance premium, is paid by your employer, and you may draw unemployment benefits when you're out of work through no fault of your own. Third form of social insurance is disability insurance. This you pay for out of your paycheck. And these benefits are available to you when you are sick or disabled and unable to work. A fourth form is workman's compensation, which is a private insurance plan your employer pays for, and if you're injured in the line of work, then benefits are paid to you. Now, you notice that I said these benefits are available to some people under some conditions. There are still a few jobs that aren't covered by Social Security. There are many jobs that aren't covered by unemployment insurance. My job isn't covered by unemployment insurance. I don't think Dr. Gould's job is. If we're out of work, if we get fired or laid off, we're thrown on our own resources. Then, too, these benefits for unemployment and for disability cover only the individual wage earner. They do not cover his family's needs. For example, in unemployment insurance, the maximum weekly benefit is $40 a week. That's a little over $160 a month when you figure that there are more than 4 weeks in a month. But this isn't enough to support a very large family. And besides, the majority of wage earners do not earn enough to qualify for that maximum benefit. The usual benefit that's paid is somewhere between $30 and $40 a week, and sometimes it's as low as just your veteran's claim of $26 a week. In disability insurance, the maximum benefit is a little higher, $50, but the same situation holds true. You have to have worked pretty hard for a pretty long time to qualify for a $50 a week benefit. These social insurance programs help working people through some temporary crises that happen, unemployment or illness or injury on the job. They are temporary. They extend for 26 weeks. Suppose you're unemployed longer than that. Or suppose you have a large family. Or suppose you were working in a job that was not covered Or suppose, as is the case with a good many women that I see in my work, you haven't worked at all, have never paid into Social Security. You've been a housewife, and then your husband dies, and you have no social insurance benefits. This is the gap that public assistance is partly designed to fill in. But more than that, the public assistance and public welfare programs give services that the social insurance programs do not. Give casework services, family counseling, marital counseling, vocational guidance, many other services, such as help with child behavior problems when children are seriously affected by a father's illness or a mother's death or a father's desertion. Thank you.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I don't know if you could hear too well in the back. Can you? You can't.
No?
You can jiggle that.
I'll shout a little louder.
No, I don't know if this has ever been working right since we've got the thing. Okay. See what we can do with it.
The public welfare programs that I'm going to be talking about are established in the federal government under the Social Security Act, which was developed during the 30s when the Depression taught us that people could be unemployed, that sickness and poverty could happen to anybody, not just to people who didn't know quite how to make it in the first place. The Social Security Act at present provides for five major forms of public welfare. The easiest way to remember these is by just running through the alphabet. The forms A, B, C, D: aid to the aged, aid to the blind, aid to children, and aid to the disabled. There's a fifth type of public assistance, which is new: medical care, which is direct payment to physicians. This is not really a separate form. It is one that exists in these first four A, B, C, D that I've mentioned. And a sixth type of public assistance is a local kind that is not included in the Social Security Act, known as county general relief, county aid, home relief, and a number of other things that I don't think I ought to use in the classroom. Under the Social Security Act, a state may develop its own public welfare plan. If the plan meets federal standards, then federal funds are granted to the state to carry the plan out. The federal standards are as follows. First, the plan must be statewide. That is, if a state is to receive federal funds for any single program, every aspect of that program must be uniform throughout every part of the state. Every county, every town, every rural area must provide the same services. Secondly, the state must pay its share of the costs. This is not a free program. What share the state pays depends on what program it is, a very complicated set of formulas which I don't try to remember, and I'm not going to try to tell them to you. But it operates on slightly better than a 50-50 basis, with the state paying somewhat more than half of the cost. A third regulation is that there must be a single state agency to supervise all programs. You cannot have one agency in San Francisco administering public welfare for Northern California and another one in Southern California administering a different kind of program. Fourthly, there must be properly supervised administration, which includes rather rigid personnel standards operated under civil service. The next four qualifications are, to my mind, the most important, and they are certainly the most important to any person who might be asking a public welfare agency for help. First, the federal government provides that any relationship between a welfare agency and its client be confidential. For example, in standing up here, telling you illustrations about things that might have happened in my agency. They will be not fictitious, but they will be very thoroughly disguised. It is against federal regulation for any welfare agency to publish or disclose in any way to any person without the written consent of the client any information about that family. The second one that is of importance to our clients is that anyone may apply. Not everyone is going to be eligible for a program, but anyone has the right to come to a welfare agency and sign a written application and expect to have his application investigated. Thirdly, the federal government provides for opportunity for fair hearing for any person who feels that he has been unjustly or arbitrarily treated, or for any person who feels that the local agency has made a mistake, or for any person who just doesn't happen to like one of the laws he runs into in the agency. He may use it as a test case. Fourthly, and I think perhaps this is the one that causes the most public controversy, the federal government requires that all public assistance payments, in order to meet federal standards, must be made in an unrestricted cash payment. I am not allowed to tell any of my clients how to spend their money. I am permitted to establish with them how much they need. Beyond that, my responsibility comes to a short and quick end. Once they receive their check, it is theirs to spend as they choose. Under these, how many did I list? Eight standards, the state may develop its own program. Now, these standards are broad and rather flexible, so no two state programs will be alike. For example, some states require that public assistance recipients be American citizens. Some states do not. California does require citizenship in its old age assistance program, but in none of the others. Residence qualifications will vary. You may not exceed the federal regulation, which states that you may not ask a claimant to have more than 5 out of the last 9 years of residence in the state. California uses that maximum requirement. However, in answer to a good many of the questions that arise regarding people moving into California to take advantage of our old age assistance program, the average length of residence of old age assistance recipients in this state is 31 years prior to application. States do not have to provide all of these programs. For example, in 1950, the federal government added a program for assistance to the permanently and totally disabled. Some states immediately followed suit and added it to their state programs. California only got around to it last October. The program went into effect October 1st. 7 years late. In view of all of these variations, if we're going to consider how public welfare works, we'll have to stick to California if we're to cover the subject in 1 hour. In California, basic public welfare law is the Welfare and Institutions Code. This is part of state law, just like the Civil Code or the Penal Code. It's established by the state legislature and the voters. The basic principles in the Welfare and Institutions Code, we abbreviate W&I Code, are formulated into rule, regulation, and overall policy by the State Social Welfare Board, which is a body of 7 people appointed by the governor. The State Social Welfare Board determines policy and also hears the appeals. It acts as the court for the Department of Social Welfare. The State Department of Social Welfare is the executive body. It is responsible for seeing to it that all these programs are carried out. It writes the manuals, issues the bulletins, and supervises the local agencies. Direct administration of all of these programs is handled by the local agencies. They're usually called county welfare departments. In some counties, they're called Department of Public Welfare, Bureau of Public Assistance, Department of Social Welfare. The county welfare department takes the applications of people who come to ask for service, makes investigations, determines whether or not they are to receive services or assistance, and administers all services and all payment. County welfare departments offer services through 14 different welfare programs. These fall roughly into two groups, public assistance and service. The public assistance programs are those which involve money payments to families or to individuals. The Social Security Act, as I said, provides for four major types: aged, blind, children, and disabled. In California, we have two additional programs that are unique to California. They come under the B classification, aid to the blind. A secondary program to aid to the blind called aid to partially self-supporting blind, and a service program for the blind called prevention of blindness. The programs of service to individuals and to their families are five in number. Homemaker service, I'm not going to go into any detail on these at this point, I'll get to them later. Homemaker service, child welfare services, protective services for children, licensing, and that is licensing of boarding homes for the aged and boarding homes for children, and adoptions. No one of these programs stand alone. They all interlock and overlap with each other. For example, I call old age assistance an assistance program and homemaker service a service program, but the same person may receive benefits from both of these services. The same child might be involved with aid to needy children. He might be in a licensed foster home, which would involve boarding home licensing. He might be under the supervision of a trained child welfare worker, in which case he would be involved in the third program, child welfare services. But although they do overlap, I'll go through them separately for the sake of simple note-taking. The best-known public assistance program in California is old age security. This is often called the old age pension. Actually, pension is a misnomer. A pension, like Social Security or teacher's retirement, is a retirement benefit that you have paid for and that is guaranteed to you upon retirement regardless of your circumstances. Old age security is a public assistance program based on need. It's rather like Social Security in that it's a retirement program and that there is a minimum age qualification, 65. But there are major differences. Social Security requires that you've paid into the fund. Old age security does not even require that you have paid taxes. Social Security is paid to you on the assumption that you have retired from active employment. That is the sense in which retirement is used there. In old age assistance, retirement means simply that you're no longer earning enough to live on. And in addition to this, you must be in need, have limited resources, and have no relatives who are able to assume your support. And this frequently happens that an elderly person will come to apply for assistance. He has children who perhaps could support him, but because of family difficulties, the children don't want to support him, or he won't accept money from his children. Here we have an illustration of the kind of breakdown in family relations that can bring people to public assistance. The second program that I had listed there is B, blind aid. Here we have three programs under one administration in California: aid to the needy blind, aid to partially self-supporting blind, and prevention of blindness. To qualify for blind aid, a person does not need to be totally blind. Rather, the definition is economic blindness. To quote from the law, this means a visual defect not to exceed 2200 in the better eye with the best possible correction. Now, that's not 20/20 vision by a long shot, but it is vision. However, without special training, a person with such limited vision would not be able to earn a living. A second qualification for blind aid, if you do not meet this one, some people may have perfectly good vision, but through a very limited area, the condition known as tunnel vision. They see life through a pinhole, and what they see clearly, but have no peripheral, no side vision at all. So the first requirement for blind aid is that you meet these qualifications with respect to a visual deficiency. Other eligibility requirements are the same as for old age security: residence and limited resources. In blind aid, you do not need to be an American citizen. Aid to the partially self-supporting blind is one of the programs that I said was unique to California. It's administered in the same way, except that this kind of assistance is available to blind people who have already established an adequate plan for self-support. They do not need training. They do not need a push into being self-supporting. They already have their plan, but they need some financial help and perhaps some social service while they are getting their plan fully underway and before they can be entirely independent. In this program, the limitations regarding resources are a little bit more liberal. In order to permit a blind person who has a business, for example, to own his own tools and equipment, or to own a lease, or to own a place of business, to own an inventory if he runs a store, the second program for the blind that is unique to California is prevention of blindness. This form of assistance is provided for people who would otherwise be eligible for aid to the blind and who would otherwise be economically blind, but who could be cured or who could prevent further loss of vision, or who could maintain their vision where it is now without having to receive public assistance. If medical care or treatment, such as, for example, cataract removal, will improve the condition or hold it where it is without getting worse, and the person meets certain eligibility requirements, the state will pay the entire cost of whatever medical care is necessary. For example, if a person is developing cataracts and cannot afford the medical care necessary to have them removed, the state will pay for the surgery, the hospitalization, all the doctor fees involved, will pay for post-operative care, and for the glasses that practically everybody who has ever had cataracts removed must wear. I'm going to skip the order A, B, C, D, and skip to D, which in our lexicon is the third program. This is the new one, aid to the permanently and totally disabled. This form of assistance is provided for severely disabled individuals, not families. In this program, disability means not just physical disability, but also mental disability. For example, severe and uncurable mental illness or severe mental deficiency. Most forms of mental illness are not considered permanently disabling. A person suffering from an acute psychosis might be totally disabled at the moment, but we are beginning to realize that even the most severe forms of mental illness can be cured. So not too many mentally ill will qualify for this program. The disability must be both permanent and total. For example, the mentally ill person that I mentioned might be totally disabled, but the disability is not permanent. Or a man might come to apply for aid to the permanently and totally disabled who has lost a leg. This is a permanent disability, but it's not totally disabling. Again, there are other eligibility requirements involving personal resources, income, property, savings, and so on. I don't think it is necessary for you to know what they are. They change with every legislative session. The C program is one of the most controversial, aid to needy children. The purpose of this program is to help children and their families when income has stopped or when income has been seriously diminished by reason of the death, absence, or illness of a parent, either parent, mother or father. For example, suppose the father has died, the mother has no work experience, and even if she had, she would not be able to leave home to work without depriving her children of her own attention and care. And she has no resources to permit her just to stay at home and take care of her children. Or suppose the mother is bedridden and the father has to quit his job because somebody has to stay home and take care of the children and he can't afford to hire a housekeeper. Or suppose a father is temporarily disabled and may be drawing disability insurance, but he's drawing $30 a week and he has 6 children. In some of these cases, mothers can work. More than half of the mothers in American society right now are working, holding jobs outside of their homes. But many women have no work experience, or there are other problems in the family situation which make it impossible for her to go to work. Perhaps the children have health problems. Perhaps the children have behavior problems and need closer attention. Perhaps also, if it's a case of a sick father, the mother has to stay home to take care of him. Eligibility requirements for this kind of aid are then, first, the child must be deprived in some way of the normal care and support of one or the other, or both, parents. Secondly, there must be insufficient income to support the family. Now, you'll notice in each of the programs I've mentioned, I've said insufficient income. I haven't said no income. These are grant-in-aid programs. They operate to individuals somewhat the way federal grants-in-aid operate to states on a matching basis. If a family has income and that income is not sufficient to support them, the state will supplement that income up to whatever they need within certain maximums. If they have no income at all, then the state will still provide whatever they need up to certain maximums. Then there are also requirements regarding residence and other personal resources such as property. In addition to these basic eligibility requirements, the family, in order to receive aid to needy children, must be willing to accept whatever social services may be necessary to help the family get back on its feet economically and socially. For example, if it's a situation in which the father has deserted the family, the mother is required to assist the welfare department in locating him. I hope I don't have any absent fathers in here. Locating him not only to pry money out of him for the support of the children, but also to see if there's any way in which the marriage could be patched up. Or if not patched up, at least some way in which the children could have some semblance of a normal relationship with their own father, even if he doesn't live with them. A second service that the welfare department will offer is providing medical care so that sick parents or sick children can be given adequate medical treatment to return them to health and independence. A third service that a welfare department might offer would be in providing training or education for people who, because of illness or injury, are out of work and can't go back to their old work. Or in providing training or education for a person who has never worked and needs to fit himself for a job. For example, a truck driver who is stricken with severe tuberculosis and is hospitalized for a long time, and when he is released from the hospital is told that he can go back to work, yes, but it has to be a sedentary job. He's an outdoor man. He doesn't know a desk job. We will refer him, perhaps to the vocational counseling services of the Department of Employment, perhaps to the State Bureau of Vocational Rehabilitation for testing, counseling, and guidance in helping him to choose a profession, and then we will support him while he is learning that profession. A fourth service that a welfare department might offer to its people, and an important one, is helping families learn how to manage their income. Not only so that they can live adequately on a relatively limited income from public assistance, but also so that when they do go back to work, they will be able to stay out of debt, make some savings, and have some kind of future security in case the same thing happens again. Probably the most interesting, at least to the staff, the most interesting service that a county welfare gives is its direct services to children. Helping children who have behavior problems learn how to adjust and live a normal life with their groups. Helping children who have school problems. Helping children who have health problems. Helping children who have problem parents. Actually, what we do there is help the parent, and this takes care of the child. In carrying out all of these services, the welfare department might call on a number of other agencies. I've already mentioned the Department of Employment and the Bureau of Vocational Rehabilitation. These are probably the public agencies we work the most closely with. We also work quite closely with the Office of the District Attorney, as I've already indicated, with public schools, teachers, school guidance personnel, with the County Health Department, with the Probation Department, the Juvenile Court, practically any other public service agency you might name. Now, families are not forced to accept all of these services. Individual plans are worked out with each individual family, in terms of its individual problems and needs. Both the family and the agency participate in a mutual working out of what is necessary. Each family remains free to make its own plans if they don't happen to like the one we offer. And while the plan is being carried out, the welfare department will support financially. I mentioned that there is a fifth federal program, medical care. Actually, this won't affect very many people. You have to be receiving public assistance already before you qualify under this program. But it is a program of direct payment to doctors, dentists, chiropractors, osteopaths, pharmacists, for medical or health services given to people in need. In financial need. You know that the only free medical service that the community provides is the county hospital, which is always overcrowded, understaffed, and you wait in line. So beginning also last October, the state will pay medical costs direct to the physician of the family's choice. All the claims that the physician sends in are subject to review by a medical board to assure that people aren't just shopping around for doctors and taking medicine where they can get it. But it does provide better medical care than public assistance people have ever had in the past. These five categories of service, aged, blind, disabled, children, and medical care, provide the bulk of financial services to individuals. But what about the many people who don't fall into one of those categories? They're not yet aged, or they may be aged but not yet American citizens. Or they're children over the age of 18. Or they are people who are disabled temporarily. For example, I mentioned a man who has lost a leg and doesn't qualify for aid to the disabled, but he hasn't yet learned to walk. Who helps them? How about agricultural laborers who are seasonally out of work? Or pea pickers? These people are the responsibility of their own home counties. The federal government remains silent. Here, traditionally, emergency unemployment, temporary illness, has always been the responsibility of neighbors, friends, relatives, and your own home area. The first requirement, then, for this kind of assistance, over and above the fact that you are out of work or sick and therefore in need, is that you be a resident. Now, I know that this has occasionally come up for poly students. Their wives are expecting babies. And on a poly student's income, they can't afford a fancy obstetrician, and so they would like to have their babies at the county hospital. Well, the county hospital is one of the services that is provided only to county residents. So if you have an established legal residence here, you're not entitled to medical care at the county hospital. The county hospital is outside of the welfare department's jurisdiction, so I can't speak in any great detail about problems that people might run into there. But in the welfare department, if you come for temporary short-time assistance for a week or a month, you must be a resident of the county in order to receive it. If you are not a resident of the county, we'll be only too happy to provide your transportation to the place where you do have residence and could receive assistance. The regulations in this kind of assistance are much more limited, much more stringent than they are in any of the other programs. Now, I mentioned the programs that are primarily service. These were homemaker service, licensing, child welfare services and protective services, and adoptions. These programs do not provide direct money payments to individuals or to families, although persons who are receiving financial assistance may also receive any of these services. The first one I'll mention is homemaker service. Here in San Luis Obispo County, we're a little bit proud. We're the first county in the state of California to provide this kind of service. This is a service primarily to the aged, but also to families under some circumstances. It's a program designed to help people learn to manage their environment, manage their homes. It is a training service, and it's also a supportive service for people who don't need training but who may have forgotten. For example, an aged couple living alone together with no children, no relatives living with them. The woman is sick, and her husband has to do all of the shopping, marketing, cooking, laundry, housekeeping, and he doesn't know how. Maybe he knew how to do this when he was young and a bachelor, but he's had a wife for a long time to do it for him. The county homemaker will visit
this couple once a week, twice a week, depending upon how much they need. We'll help the man learn how to prepare meals, how to plan meals, how to plan when to go to the store and what to buy. She'll help him learn to sort the laundry and get it off to the laundry on time. Occasionally, if he's too poor a cook, she may come in just on a once-a-week basis to cook a meal for them so that the two of them can have at least one decently prepared meal a week. As a service to families, younger families, I can give you one illustration of how I plan to use homemaker service in my division. Suppose you have a very young girl, say 16 or 17 years old. She was still in high school when she got married. Maybe she got married because she had to get married. Maybe she got married just because she wasn't interested in high school and did happen to be interested in the boy. She's married, and now a year later she has a baby and her husband has left her. Don't laugh. It isn't funny. The case I'm thinking about right now, the boy's in jail. No. Now, the girl is living with her in-laws. She's never had a home of her own. She's never had to cook a meal in her life, except just as all girls do at home every now and then. She's never had to change a diaper, because although she has a baby, she lives with her mother-in-law, and the mother-in-law is a very efficient person and does all of this for her. Well, it sounds like a very nice life. But when that young man gets out of jail and comes home, what kind of a home is this 17-year-old girl going to be able to provide for him? She doesn't know how to cook. She doesn't know how to keep house. Maybe he will leave her. So when school is out, the girl is still going to high school. When school is out, we plan to have the homemaker go into that home. Well, first, we plan to have her move out of her in-laws' home, find an apartment or a small house where she and the baby can live alone without a mother, and have the homemaker go into the home maybe twice a week, maybe three times a week, for half a day at a time, to teach the girl to cook, to teach her how to plan menus and how to tie one menu into another so that you don't have steak one night and don't know how to make hash out of the leftovers of roast beef the next, so that you don't have to plan each meal separately but can plan a whole week's menus at a time. She'll teach the young woman how to take care of her baby, how to take care of a husband so that when the husband comes home from jail, so that when he comes home from jail, he'll have a decent home to come to and won't have to run off and get drunk again. As I say, that service is new. Everything else that we have has an abbreviation. Aid to Needy Children is ANC. Aid to the Permanently and Totally Disabled is ATD. Boarding Homes for Children is BHC. Homemaker Service is still just Homemaker Service. We aren't used enough to it yet to give it an abbreviation. And I'm not enough used to it yet to give you a really serious illustration of how it works. The second service program that I mentioned is licensing. Licensing of boarding homes is part of the state's licensing function, just like licensing drivers or giving people fishing licenses. That is, a universal privilege is taken away, and then the state gives it back to you on a selective basis by means of a license. Unlike most other licenses, a foster home license doesn't cost you a fee. Fishing licenses cost, what, $3 basic and then $1 for each different kind of fish. Driver's licenses cost $3 and so on. Well, what are these homes that are licensed used for? Well, there are two kinds, as I said, for children and for the aged. Full-time homes away from home are sometimes needed for young children for a temporary period, either because of illness of their parents or because of inadequacy of their parents. And while the parents are being helped to become better parents, you have the children out of the home. Sometimes foster homes are needed for children during a divorce settlement when the judge rules that the child shall remain in a neutral home in order that the parents may not quarrel over him and around him. Sometimes foster homes are needed for a treatment purpose, a child with a behavior problem. Sometimes they are needed for children who have no families at all and have to have a place to live temporarily until they can be placed for adoption. For these children, the County Welfare Department recruits homes, licenses them under statewide standards, supervises them to assure both the parent and the child that the foster home is a good home, a safe home, and also offers protection to the foster parent by reason of the license, that they have been, so to speak, certified as good homes to which to trust your children. A second kind of licensing for children's homes is daycare licensing. Whenever I mention this to a poly student or to a group of poly students, I notice that the married men get rather squirmy because their wives may be taking care of all the other children in Vetville. Even to take care of a child in your own home during the daytime, not overnight, a license is required. Now, this is a regulation that is rather like speeding. Everybody does it. So you don't need to get too squirmy, particularly if you live in Vetville and you rotate, and one wife takes care of the neighbor's children one morning and then they go on, stay in the next trailer the next day. But a license is still required under the law. The standards are very much the same, except that for full-time licensing, they will come in and measure your house to make sure you have room. For licensing for daycare, I don't think we have any full-time homes licensed in Vetville. Anyone can use these homes once they're licensed. The welfare department uses them for children who are under child welfare services for treatment of behavior problems. The juvenile court uses foster homes for delinquent or seriously neglected children who have to be removed from their own homes. And just ordinary people use them. A mother who's working or going to school may use a daycare home. If a mother is sick or has to work away from home, she may place her children in a full-time home for a short period or for the period that she needs to be away. I mentioned also boarding homes for the aged. This is a kind of transitional service halfway between homemaker service, which helps the aged remain in their own homes, and removal from own home altogether to live in a custodial institution. For example, a person who is too old, too feeble, for it really to be safe for him to live alone, would perhaps be better off living in a group situation. People don't always go into aged boarding homes because they're feeble. Sometimes they go because they're lonely. And they find more satisfaction living with a small group of other people in their same age group with whom they can share common interests. Boarding homes for the aged are not large institutions. They may have 3 people. They may have 5. They may have 6. I don't know what the maximum is. When Dr. Gould was saying I'd worked in all these programs, this is the one that I know the least about.
When I was talking about ANC, Aid to Needy Children, and when I was talking about licensing, I've mentioned child welfare services.
This program is a program of service to children and to their parents. As I mentioned, behavior problems, marital problems that are affecting the whole family, as they always do. Health problems. Now, the caseworker doesn't treat the health problem. That is done by the doctor. But the caseworker will help coordinate all the services to the family and will help people bear up under serious illness. These services are provided by professionally trained caseworkers, people with at least a master's degree in social work. The primary problems that we deal with are marital. This does not always mean that we are patching up marriages. As any marital counselor will tell you, sometimes the best thing you can do for a family is tell them that it's all right to get a divorce. But you also, if you tell them that, have to help them decide what to do with their children and how best to provide the closest approximation to a normal life for their children. This is child welfare service workers' job.
Under child welfare services, there's a program known as protective services.
These are services given in behalf of a child who is in danger of becoming delinquent, is not yet delinquent, but is in danger of becoming delinquent because of gross neglect on the part of his parents. This is the one authoritative service we offer. It's the one service that is not voluntary on the part of our client. Oh, it's voluntary. We tell the parent who is mistreating his child that he doesn't have to accept our service, but if he doesn't accept it, we will refer him to the probation department and the juvenile court. A good many parents would rather do that. Simpler, cleaner activity to simply appear in court and get it over with. And then the court may decide that if the parents are incorrigible, the children will be removed, and the parent can forget about the child. He doesn't have to spend months in weekly interviews with a caseworker trying to decide what is wrong and what can be done about it. This service is initiated on complaint, as we say. That is, we get a complaint about a family from some member of the public or from some agency, the schools, the health department, and then it is our obligation to investigate the complaint, see if there is anything in it, see if the parents are willing to accept services in correcting whatever problems exist, and if not, then in referring them to the court.
I've talked about programs that are most interesting to us, child welfare services and protective services. The program that is probably of most interest to anybody who is listening to any of us is adoptions.
Adoption is primarily a service to the child. People ask, why can't I have a baby? Why can't I adopt a child? I have a good home, I have plenty of income, I have a stable marriage, I have no children of my own, and I want one. Well, we can't answer you, why can't you have a child, except to say that right at this moment there's not a child who needs you. You read about thousands of children stored away in institutions or boarding homes who are available for adoption. This is not true. There are thousands of children in institutions and foster homes, but they're not available for adoption. They haven't been given up by their parents. And in order to be available for adoption, a child must either have been abandoned or voluntarily given up. There are two kinds of adoption that an adoption agency will deal with. From the agency's standpoint, the important kind of adoption is what is known as a relinquishment adoption or an agency adoption. In this kind of adoption, a parent will come to the agency and say, either I have a child or I'm going to have a baby that I do not feel I can keep and give a home to. The parent will relinquish the child to the agency. The agency will make a careful study of the child to see what kind of youngster it is, what kind of home it will best fit into, what kind of home it needs, and then we'll select that home from a list of carefully screened applicants. The agency will place the child in the home, supervise for a period of 1 year to make sure everything works out all right, and it usually does. At the end of that year, the family appears in court, and the judge approves the adoption, and a new family is established. The second kind of adoption, I said there were two, is independent adoption, known also legally, I think, as consent adoptions, as opposed to relinquishment adoptions. In this form of adoption, under the law, ideally the way it is supposed to work out, the parent of the child selects her own adoptive parents. She decides who she thinks will be the best parent for her child. Sometimes it's a father who will be selecting the home. And will place the child directly with these people. They may be friends, they may be relatives, they may be people that the parent has just heard about and trusts. After the child is placed, the adoptive parents file a petition to the court. This is referred to the social agency, and we go out and make a similar kind of study as we do in original applications. But the child is already there. And at the end of 6 months, if we approve and the court approves, then the child is legally adopted. There are advantages and disadvantages in both kinds of adoption. In the agency type, in relinquishment adoption, sometimes mothers and children both will spend the rest of their lives wondering, where did my baby go? Who's got him? Are they being good to him? The child who is placed in an